Welcome to El Microscopio, a program exclusively dedicated to clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine. International Federation of Clinical Chemistry, IFCC. Executive Director, Dr. Hernan Ferres-Tayeb.
Member of the Committee of Evidence-Based Laboratory Medicine of the International Federation of Clinical Chemistry.
Organizing Committee, Dr. Maria Montserrat Blanes Gonzalez from Paraguay, Dr. Rosa Isabel Sierra Amor from Mexico, and Dr. Estela Raimondo from Uruguay.
El Microscopio, a program exclusively dedicated to clinical chemistry. El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
El Microscopio is presenting the IFCC World Lab Congress 2017.
El Microscopio, where health professionals can meet over the internet.
We are thankful to the audience. We have more than 100,300 Facebook likes. Let's go for more.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
The Spanish Association of Pharmaceutical Analysts and the Chilean Society of Clinical Chemistry accompany El Microscopio.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
Dr. Clifford McDonald graduated from Northwestern University Medical School, completed his internal medicine residency at Michigan State University and an infectious disease fellowship at the University of South Alabama, following which he completed a fellowship in medical microbiology at Duke University. Past positions have included associate investigation at the National Health Research Institute in Taiwan and assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Louisville. Dr. McDonald is a former officer in the Epidemic Intelligence Service and a former chief of the Prevention and Response Branch in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the CDC, where he currently serves as a senior advisor for science and integrity in the same division. He is the author or co-author of over 100 peer-reviewed publications, with his main interest in epidemiology and prevention of healthcare-associated infections and the prevention of antimicrobial resistance. Dr. McDonald is a fellow of the American College of Physicians and the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America, and a member of the Infectious Disease Society of America and American Society for Microbiology.
Professor McDonald, welcome to Microscopio.
Thank you.
In this interview, we wanted to talk about superbugs and what is the definition of hospital-acquired infections.
Well, hospital-acquired infections are infections that occur after you've been in the hospital for a couple days, usually because of bacteria that have been spread to you from other persons. Also, things like surgery or catheters make you more vulnerable to get such infections.
Can these infections appear after discharge? And if so, are these infections included in the data reported to CDC?
Yes, so healthcare-associated infections can occur after discharge. There are the subset that are hospital onset and then the others that occur post-discharge. A good example is surgical site infection. If you've had a surgery and the wound gets infected, it often doesn't show the signs of infection until you've left the hospital. There are others as well. For the example of surgical site infection, in fact, we do get that information up to 30 days post-discharge as part of the reporting of surgical site infections that hospitals do. Other types of infections that occur after discharge, we get some indication of how common they are from other surveillance systems we have, although we don't get that from every hospital.
And what are the common ways bacteria is spread in healthcare facilities?
Well, the most common way that we're always working to try to reduce is the contamination of the hands of healthcare workers. Their hands touch the patient's skin, which is contaminated with bacteria, or the bed rails, the overbed table, other places, what we call the patient care environment. All of those surfaces have bacteria which are specially adapted to cause infection in healthcare settings. Those bacteria get on the hands of the healthcare workers when they don't clean their hands, and that's one thing we're emphasizing all the time, is better attention to hand cleaning or hand hygiene. We recommend, of course, that doctors and nurses always use methods to clean their hands. The most common one in the healthcare setting that we recommend is alcohol-based hand rubs. These are very quick. They can be done in 30 seconds or less, and they're very effective. Some healthcare providers might have to clean their hands over 100 times in a shift, depending upon how many patients they might be caring for. But this is the main way that we think bacteria are getting from patient to patient, is on the hands of healthcare providers when they fail to clean their hands between patients. Another way, of course, is the environment. The surfaces I just mentioned, the bed rails, the room surfaces, the chair, those surfaces can be contaminated. Again, those surfaces can play a role in the getting the healthcare workers' hands contaminated, but also patients, a new patient coming into that same room, or maybe in the emergency department where maybe new patients are coming in every few minutes. If that surface doesn't get clean, then sometimes the next patient can get the bacteria on them directly that way. Sometimes also devices or equipment that goes from room to room can carry the bacteria on it. But it's always through direct or indirect contact.
And according to CDC, at any given time, about 1 in 25 hospital patients has at least one healthcare-associated infection. Where, in which healthcare facilities, can we find the highest infection risk? And what is the infection rate?
Yeah, so a lot of this has to do with how vulnerable the patients are and also how many of these highly vulnerable patients are located close to one another. Some of the highest infection risks that we see are in long-term acute care hospitals. This means they're almost like long-term intensive care units. The average length of stay in these facilities in the United States is about 25 days. Often these patients have, even before they came to these hospitals, these special hospitals, they've already been in the intensive care unit of a regular hospital for sometimes weeks. They often come to these long-term acute care hospitals already colonized with multidrug-resistant bacteria. And they also often, have either had surgery recently or they have catheters in them or they're on the ventilator. All these things are what we call invasive devices, and they allow the bacteria to get into the person and cause infection in that way. With that said, infection rates are still overall less than 10%. That's for any given infection, though. So many, many people, if not even the majority of long-term acute care hospital patients, will have at least one infection over their time because, again, they're often staying for 25 days or so. It becomes quite a risk. Fortunately, many of those infections can be treated quite effectively, but others have become highly resistant to antibiotics.
And how does that compare to other facilities, such as in long-term acute care?
Well, that is long-term acute care, and so those are the highest rates. Then in acute care hospitals, the rates are much lower, and generally things like routine surgeries, the infection rate is like 1% or less. One very common infection across all healthcare settings is called Clostridium difficile. It occurs about in a little less than 1% of all hospitalized patients in acute care hospitals. But acute care hospitals then have lower rates, and then still lower rates are in nursing homes. Nursing homes are a place where people do get infected, but remember that many of those patients can stay there for even years sometimes. So the overall day-to-day risk is much lower. So the highest in the long-term acute care hospital, medium in the acute care, and lowest in nursing homes.
Could you please tell us about antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which is the most common in hospitals?
Well, Clostridium difficile, although it's not... It is resistant to some antibiotics, but the resistance that it has is not necessarily to the drugs that we're using to treat it, okay? Most antibiotic resistance, when we talk about it, we're worried about it because it makes it harder to treat the infection. And so Clostridium difficile is a little bit different in that way, but it is the most common single cause of any healthcare-associated infection right now in the United States. But other very common ones include things like methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, or MRSA. That has been a long-standing problem, and Staphylococcus aureus can cause a lot of infections. Other multidrug-resistant gram-negative bacteria are of concern. One in particular is called carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, or CRE. These are highly resistant gram-negative bacteria that can cause urinary tract infection or bloodstream infection or other infections as well. And some of them can even become virtually untreatable with all the antibiotics we have currently.
And can these infections be prevented, these infections of resistant bacteria?
Yes. We recommend, first and foremost, is to do the things that prevent any kind of infection. I've mentioned to you surgical site infections. There are procedures that people can do to try to prevent anyone from getting any kind of surgical site infection. It includes using the right amount of antibiotic just before the surgery, careful hygiene we've talked about already, and other careful care of the surgical wound. There's other things you can do to prevent other infections, like the infections from catheters and things. A second thing is to prevent the transmission of the multidrug resistant organisms going from one patient to another. We've talked about cleaning your hands. The healthcare providers should clean their hands. We even recommend that patients speak up and tell their providers, did you clean your hands? Or maybe that we know that can be difficult to talk that way to the provider. You can even say, well, the CDC says I'm supposed to ask you if you've cleaned your hands. We also want the hospitals to help make the patient feel more comfortable talking to the doctor or nurse that way, in a polite way, to asking them to clean their hands. That's so important for preventing the transmission of these multidrug-resistant organisms from one patient to another. And then finally, it's very important that antibiotics be used very carefully. We call this antibiotic stewardship. And this will prevent some infections directly, like Clostridium difficile infection. It actually is caused because of antibiotics. So if you use less antibiotic, you'll prevent some of those infections directly. And then as we use, if we're more careful about antibiotic use, we'll have less antibiotic resistance.
Well, we've heard that, well, with hand cleaning is so important that you recently launched a campaign called Clean Hands Count. So I guess that was a very significant campaign and about cleaning our hands. Would you like to say anything about that campaign?
Yeah, I've mentioned some of it already in my remarks. It is something that we have been talking about for a long time, of course. It's been known about for over 100 years how important it is in hospitals and healthcare settings for providers to clean their hands. And yet we still have problems. In some studies, it appears that providers, healthcare workers, might clean their hands less than 50% of the time they're supposed to. Well, that's not because they're bad people. It doesn't mean that they're just forgetful either. It's just that there's a lot going on in healthcare all the time. You know, there's so many. If you've had a loved one or yourself have been in the hospital recently, especially in an intensive care unit, you know those places are just amazingly high tech. A lot going on all the time. A lot of things that the providers are thinking about all the time. So it's easy to start to overlook something as basic as cleaning your hands. So, yes, we launched this campaign back on May 5th, which was actually World Hand Hygiene Day, a day that WHO also acknowledges. And it's a campaign that really is trying to get the message out to this generation of healthcare providers of just how important it is, and also to patients. to get patients to feel empowered, like I said before, to even ask their providers, their healthcare workers, their doctors, their nurses, did you clean your hands before you examined me? Do you mind just doing it again in front of me? Those types of things for patients to feel like they can be a part of this. And also we talk there again about the importance of technique. Alcohol-based hand sanitizers or hand rubs do make it a lot easier, and they are very effective. They are not associated with resistance or any concerns like that. The hand washing works too well, but it just takes a lot more effort, and alcohol can just be applied so quickly. And so that is our recommended method for cleaning hands in the healthcare setting. And as we talked about, some healthcare providers might have to clean their hands over 100 times in a shift. So it's important that they have a method for doing so very quickly. It's important that they get the right amount of the alcohol-based hand rub on the hands. If you get the right amount on your hands, you'll probably do a good job. If you get the right amount, your hands should stay wet for about 20 seconds. And you want to, of course, get that over all the surfaces of the hands. Some areas commonly missed are the fingers, the tips of the fingers and the crevices, sometimes the backs of the hands and things like that. So we want to get all that covered. And if you allow them to dry, then you're good to go. So there are ways of making patients safer through cleaning your hands, and that's what that Clean Hands Count campaign is all about.
And is there any global surveillance network or efforts and a way to reduce the threat of antibiotic resistance?
Well, there is not one overall unified global system. There is, though, increasing collaboration between countries. We work closely with Europe in terms of coordinating our actions. Examples just last week, or earlier this week it was, I think, that we released a notice of a problem of an antibiotic-resistant organism both in England and here in the United States. Not that we have the same problem here, but just warning people that it may be coming, and it's an antibiotic-resistant yeast or Candida species. So that's just one of the examples of coordination. Certainly WHO has given recommendations about what kind of surveillance to do. I think CDC also sees the need for countries to develop their own surveillance systems that are adapted to their settings, that attend to their specific problems. Everyone, I think, agrees that we want to be doing surveillance on both the types of antibiotic resistance, numbers of infections, but then also on the antibiotic use, because antibiotics are an important national and world resource. The activity of antibiotics is a international resource. And as these organisms all become resistant, we lose that resource, and it's something we need to preserve for everyone on this planet and for future generations as well. So it is very key that we coordinate in these ways in terms of the appropriate surveillance.
Thank you very much, Professor McDonald. It's been a pleasure to have you in Microscopio.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
We are in El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
On Wednesday at 1 p.m.
Argentina and Uruguay time.
At 11 a.m.
Ecuador, Panama, Peru, Colombia, and Mexico time.
And at 6 p.m.
Spain time.
El Microscopio.
El Microscopio.
It's no shame that love's a game that I can only play with you. What I'm saying is I'm here waiting for you. I've seen the light, I'm satisfied that the brightest star. Turn into nights.
days turn into today. Don't think I'm out playing, 'cause I'm inside waiting for you. I felt alive, high, I'm satisfied that the highest high is you.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world. Our correspondents in every country. Alberto Barrantes in Costa Rica. Álvaro Justiniano Gross in Bolivia. Ana Leticia Maselli in Guatemala. Carmen Cecilia Almonacid Urrego in Colombia. Cristina Cerveto from Uruguay. Eduardo Aranda in Chile. Graciela Velázquez from Paraguay. María del Carmen Pasquel from Ecuador.
We are in El Microscopio, a program about clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
Dr. Umar Hassan is a graduate student of electrical engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is currently working as a research assistant at Micro and Nanotechnology Laboratory in Dr. Bashi's Laboratory of Integrated Biomedical Micro-Nanotechnology and Applications, LIBNA. Previously, he has worked as a development engineer at the School of Science and Engineering in Lahore University of Management Sciences.
Professor Umar Hassan, welcome to Microscopio.
Thank you for inviting me.
In this interview, we wanted to talk about differential immunocapture biochip, which offers specific leukocyte counting for HIV diagnosis. And our first question is, what leukocyte subpopulations can the new device detect?
Well, our biochip, just based on the electrical interrogation of the cells, can count total white blood cells, its subtypes including lymphocytes and granulocyte monocytes. Furthermore, it can also enumerate specific cells of those subtypes like CD4 T lymphocytes or CD8 T lymphocytes based on the immunocapture or the affinity-based capture of the cells.
What is the importance of determining CD4 plus and CD8 plus in patients with HIV?
When a patient contracts HIV, that virus starts killing CD4 T cells in the blood. So CD4 and CD8 T cells constitute the main defense of the body. They recruit other cells to fight against other pathogens and infections. So the number of those cells really is really important. So that's why doctors usually look at those numbers. And whenever, for example, the number of the CD4 T cells falls below a certain threshold, they usually recommend the antiretroviral therapy. Now, that threshold changes in different regions of the world differently. For example, in US, whenever the CD4 T cells falls below a threshold of 500 cells per microliter, the doctors initiate the antiretroviral therapy. The objective of that therapy is, of course, to increase the number of these CD4 T cells. Now, as the CD4 T cells are decreasing, the CD8 T cells are increasing in the blood as the HIV virus also multiplies. Counting the CD4 and CD8 T cells gives a more overall assessment of the immune system, and it also we can track the progression of the disease over time by counting both of these cell types.
And what are the disadvantages of the methodology that is currently used to determine CD4 and CD8 cells?
Well, in all the healthcare settings currently, the gold standard is using a big bulky machine, which is called as a flow cytometer. I'm just going to compare in different ways the flow cytometer versus our chip now. the first one is just a cost comparison. That flow cytometer, the one-time cost is like $100,000, and its maintenance cost is yearly approximately $10,000, and it requires a few trained personnel to operate that instrument. As compared now, if I were to compare it to my device, to our device, it's pretty automated, and it does not require that high level of training to operate that instrument. Another comparison would be just the volume of the blood that is used. In the flow cytometer, phlebotomists usually draw 4 milliliters of blood from the patient. However, in our device, we just use 10 microliters of the blood. Now, just to give you a picture, one drop of blood is approximately 30 to 40 microliters. And we are using just 1/3 to 1/4 of a drop of blood in our device. So in comparison, our device uses approximately 300 to 400 times less blood as compared to the standard flow cytometer. The third important comparison is the manual processing of the blood. In flow cytometers, for example, for CD4 and CD8 T cell counting, manual processing of the blood is required. More specifically, they have to stain the blood sample with the CD4 and CD8 T cell conjugated antibodies. However, in our chip, it's just infusing the whole blood into the chip, and everything is just integrated and it's automated. So our device can potentially be very, very cheap. It uses just less than a drop of blood, and it requires no manual processing of the blood samples.
And what are the characteristics of this new device, and can it be considered a biosensor of microfluidics?
Yes, definitely. Our device works on the principles of microfluidics, electrical interrogation of cells, and immunocapture technique. Now, if I would just go into a little bit more detail, our device has three important components in it. The first component is the lysing module. That module essentially lyses all the red blood cells. So why there is a need to lyse them is because in 1 microliter of blood, there are 5 million red blood cells as compared to just 5,000 white blood cells. So in order to have that accuracy, we want to get rid of all the red blood cells. So our first module of the chip ensures that, in which we infuse all the 10 microliters of blood and the other lysing and the quenching reagents, it ensures that it gets rid of all the red blood cells and preserves the white blood cell population. The second module that is based on the electrical interrogation of the cells, now the preserved white blood cells flows through a microfluidic channels which are aligned to the platinum microfabricated electrodes. And as the cell passes through that Coulter microfluidic channel, it generates a voltage bipolar pulse. And we count all of those pulses to know how many cells are there. The third module is the capture module, the cell capture module, in which we had initially actually adsorbed the anti-CD4 or CD8 antibodies in the chamber. So whenever a CD4 or CD8 T cell passes through that chamber, it gets captured, and then we count the remaining cell that flows through the capture chamber. So essentially, by taking the difference of the entrance minus exit cell counts, we know how many cells are captured. So this is how we are capturing the cells. Now, our chip is essentially based on the principles of microfluidics and nanotechnology. So, yes.
All right. And what steps or what requirements should we have to follow to process a sample with a device?
Actually, none. If I would compare it with the flow cytometer again, flow cytometer requires manual processing of the blood, and there's no specific requirement to process the blood in our case, in that terms. It's just infusing the whole blood into the chip, and then everything, the lysing, the capture, everything is integrated into the chip, and there's no external blood processing that is required.
And how does the method work with CD4 values, which are lowered to 100 cells?
In order to count the cells, less than 200 cells per microliter or millimeters cube, we need to have a very accurate cell counting. Now, our two components in the chip ensures that we will be able to have that accuracy. The first is the lysing module, again. We have optimized those lysing conditions so that we can preserve that white blood cell population. And second is that capture module, in which we have optimized the shear stress or the flow rates at which the cells get captured in order to ensure that we get the maximum efficiency of the CD4 or CD8 T cell capture, and while also ensuring that we would have minimum non-specific capture of the other cell types. Now, in our first clinical trials, we have shown a very big dynamic range, actually, of the CD4 T cell counts from 50 cells per microliter to 1,000 cells per microliter. Over this dynamic range, we have counted the cells.
And what is the correlation coefficient of this method considering the gold standard?
In our first clinical trials, we obtained the blood samples from HIV-infected individuals from Champaign-Urbana Public Health District over here in Champaign, Illinois. And we ran those samples on our biochip, and we sent the same samples to the hospital where they use the flow cytometers and give us the CD4 and CD8 counts. And then we compared our biochip CD4 and CD8 counts with the flow cytometer counts that we obtained from the hospital. And we have found the correlation coefficients to be around 0.9. One being the perfect correlation in between the two methods. And then we have talked to a lot of clinicians, and 0.9 is very, very acceptable correlation coefficient as compared to the gold standard.
And can this device be used for point-of-care testing?
Yes, definitely. The primary goal or the primary intention of making such devices is that we would be able to use these devices for the point-of-care testing. Now, this device has the potential to be portable, completely automatic, and does not require any manual processing of the blood. It requires a very small volume, so all of these things ensure that it can be used as a point-of-care testing. Furthermore, in order to emphasize on the point-of-care testing thing, for example, just to give you some numbers, around 35 million people are infected with HIV/AIDS around the world, and 70% of them are living in sub-Saharan Africa with limited resources and availability to these facilities, to these expensive machines like flow cytometers. So there's a tremendous need of having such point-of-care devices that can be used in those underdeveloped regions of the world, and also it can also bring down a cost a lot in the developed regions of the world like US and Europe.
Yes, it sounds very interesting. So would you like to say any final comment on this new device?
Yes, I would like to say actually more on the project that this project was undertaken under the supervision and the guidance of Professor Rashid Bashir at the Department of Bioengineering at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and the project was funded by the grants from University of Illinois, from National Science Foundation, from National Institutes of Health, and some grants from the Foundation. And this device, my final thoughts would be that this device has a huge potential, which can revolutionize the CD4 and CD8 T-cell counting, both in the developed world and the underdeveloped world.
Thank you very much, Professor Fumehasian. It has been a pleasure to have you in Microscopio.
All right, thank you so much for
okay,
inviting.
Thank you.
El Microscopio. In www.infobiochimica.com, you'll find a link to the Clinical Chemistry Training Council and consultation website of Clinical Chemistry and Laboratory Medicine.
I was raised up believing I was somehow unique, like a snowflake, distinct among snowflakes, unique in each way you'd conceive. And now after some thinking, I'd say I'd rather be a functioning cog in some great machinery, serving something beyond me. But I don't know what that will be. I'll get back to you someday. Soon you will see. What's my name? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that will do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for me. And yeah, I'm tongue-tied and dizzy, and I can't
Why should I wait for anyone else? And I know you will keep me on the shelf. I'll come back to you someday soon. If I had an orchard, I'd work till I'm wrong. If I had an orchard, I'd work till I'm sore. You would wait tables.
This is El Microscopio on infobiochimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world, our correspondents in every country. Rosa Isabel Sierra Amor from Mexico, José Jara from Peru, Milagros de la Rosa from Dominican Republic, Miriam Aguilera from Honduras, Rafael Calafel from Spain, Mario Chávez Villalobos from Costa Rica, Dante Yáñez from Bolivia, Leverton Ortiz from Chile.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
El Microscopio is presenting the IFCC World Lab Congress 2017.
El Microscopio.
An online radio program about biochemistry.
News.
IFCC President Position. The term of IFCC President-elect commences on January the 1st, 2017, to be confirmed as IFCC President for the period January the 1st, 2018, until 31st December, 2020. Three candidates have been nominated by their national societies and all applications were declared valid. IFCC officers' elections take place electronically and IFCC full members constitute the voting members. For more information, you can visit www.ifcc.org.
News.
IFCC Awards. IFCC is proud to announce its distinguished award for presentation at the IFCC Congress in October 2017, Durban, South Africa. The IFCC Distinguished Awards will be conferred to scientists and clinicians who work in clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine or related disciplines to publicize their exceptional research and other contributions that have improved medical and healthcare and to stimulate and encourage other scientists to accelerate their efforts in advancing clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine.
News.
IFCC E-News Flash. In the September IFCC E-News Flash, you will find updates on the Euromed Lab Congress in Athens from the 11th to the 15th June 2017, the presentation of the EJIFCC on cardiac biomarkers, and a highlight on the E-Academy webinar on children's reference intervals, the first of a series of four. Subscribe to ensure you receive all the latest news on www.ifcc.org.
We were married on a rainy day. The sky was yellow and the grass was gray. We signed the papers and we drove away. I do it for your love. The rooms were musty and the pipes were cold. All that winter we shared a cold. Drank all the orange juice that we could hold. I do it for your love. Found a rug in an old junk shop. Brought it home to you. Along the way the colors ran. The orange bled the blue. Of tears, the northern and the southern hemispheres, love emerges and it disappears. I do it for your love. I do it for your love. Thank you.
We are in El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com
on Wednesday at 1 p.m.
Argentina time
and at 12 p.m.
Paraguay, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Bolivia, Chile, and Cuba time. El Microscopio. Agenda. Offering courses, workshops, seminars, congresses.
Agenda. The 9th Palestinian Conference of Laboratory Medicine in Ramallah, Palestine, from August the 11th to August the 13th, 2016.
Microscopia.
58th National Conference of the Hungarian Society of Laboratory Medicine in Hungary, from August 25th to August 27th, 2016.
Agenda.
The Benefits and Challenges of Point-of-Care Testing Across the Clinical Spectrum, 26th International CPOCT Symposium in Copenhagen, Denmark, from September 21st to September 24th, 2016.
Agenda.
The SPC, ML and IFTC Joint Symposium in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, on September 29th, 2016.
Agenda.
The First Scientific and Professional Congress of Cordoba, Argentina, Congress of Biochemistry, 2016. October the 4th to October the 8th, 2016.
Agenda.
The 2016 Conference of the Association of Clinical Chemists of Nigeria, in Nigeria, in October the 12th to October the 14th, 2016.
Agenda.
The 48th National Congress of Laboratory Medicine, the Patient's Central Role Between Laboratory and Clinical Practice in Torino, Italy, from October the 18th to October the 20th, 2016.
Agenda.
The 10th National Congress of Clinical Laboratory in Zaragoza, Spain, from October the 19th to October 21st, 2016.
Agenda.
The joint meeting of the 3rd Congress of Controversies in Thrombosis and Hemostasis and the 8th Russian Conference of Clinical Hemocytology and Hemorrhagy in Moscow, Russia, from October the 20th to October 22nd, 2016.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world. Our correspondents in every country. Stella Raimondo from Uruguay. Fernando Ruiz Cerda from Chile. Montserrat González from Paraguay. Isabel Fierro from Ecuador. José Francisco Valle from Mexico. Oswaldo Ruiz Narváez from Costa Rica. Patrocinio Trecas from Spain. Rodolfo Aquino Cáceres from El Salvador.
Please remember me happily by the rosebush laughing with bruises on my chin. The time when we counted every black car passing your house beneath the hill and up until someone caught us in the kitchen with maps, a mountain range, and a piggy bank. A vision to remove dimension, and please remember me fondly. I heard from someone you're still pretty, and then they went on to say that the pearly gates have such eloquent graffiti, like we'll meet again and fuck the man. Tell my mother not to worry, and angels with their great handshakes, but always done in such a hurry. And please remember me as in the dream we had as rug-burned babies among the fallen trees, but fast asleep beside the lions and the ladies that call you what you like, and even might give a gift for your behavior, a fleeting chance to see a trapeze, swing her high as any savior, and please remember me, my misery, and how it lost me. All I wanted, those dogs that love the rain and chasing trains, the colored birds above there running in circles round the well to where it spells on the wall behind St. Peter, so bright on cinder gray in spray paint. Who the hell can see forever? And please remember me seldomly in the car behind the carnival, my hand between your knees. You turn from me, said the trapeze act was wonderful, but never meant to last. The clowns that passed saw me just come up with anger when it filled with circus dogs. The parking lot, it had an element of danger. And please remember me. Finally, no. Drawing of God and Lucifer, a boy and girl, an angel kissing on the center of monkey and a man, and a marching trappy swinger
Thanks a lot, everybody. Thank you.
The team of El Microscopio. Hernan Ferris Taye.
Hernan Ferris Taye.
Silvana Buja.
Silvana Buja.
Nicolas Bem.
Nicolas Bem.
Sebastian Zener.
Sebastian Zener.
Belen Landi.
Belen Landi.
And Marcelo Elias.
And Marcelo Elias.